This is Mark Gibbons. It is November 7th, 2012. I'm conducting an interview with David Thomas, a poet from Missoula, Montana, in regard to Ed Leahy. And then I'll just yell across the room as far as... Do you want to just... I don't know, I thought... you know, what's your first... if you can remember, when you first encountered Ed or his work, or how did you first come across Ed Leahy?
Well, like I mentioned in that elegy, the first time that I'd ever had any inkling that Ed was in the world was when I was taking a English comp over at the university when I was a junior, I think, and we were studying T.S. Eliot and, you know, and The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and she handed out some mimeographed copies of Ed's poems. I didn't know who Ed was, but, you know, he wrote, among them was Confederate Jacks, you know, and or an early version of it. But it's pretty much been the same poem through the years, I guess. And, you know, I'd kind of forgotten all about that until I'd been working on this memoir project and digging through all my old records and whatever I managed to salvage from my university career, you know, and I happened to come across these mimeograph poems of Leahy's, and I thought, Jesus Christ.
Wow, mimeograph.
Yeah.
Who was the teacher, remember?
Oh, no, not right offhand.
Some gal,
she was, had kind of a rough complexion. Dark haired, but a nice gal, you know. And mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think I knew anything about poetry at that point. And I,
what year, Dave? Remember?
Oh, you know, I've been. Well, it would have been probably the fall of '68, I suppose. You know.
And Ed was still teaching at the university at that time? Maybe.
Yeah, he may have been. You know, he was either teaching or he might have been a TA or he might have been, you know, still in the graduate program. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, all those guys were around. You know, that's just when I. Well, that's when I got to know Warwick and Bluen and all these guys. They showed up, you know, around the same time. You know, and Vietnam War was going on. You know, thinking, you know, and I was in ROTC at the time, you know, and then figuring that I was going to end up being an Army officer and not any kind of a poet or anything like that, you know. And so I just, you know, tucked those poems of Ed's away. I don't know if they ever came up in a writing assignment or anything. I remember writing a paper about Prufrock, you know, and I managed to come out of it with an A-, which kind of surprised me because I didn't think I had any ability to analyze a poem at all, but I did.
So that was kind of your first literature class?
Well, it was just, you had to take comp classes in order to graduate, you know, but, and
right.
To get your BA, you know. I'd struggled through, you know, I used to think I was pretty good in English because in high school, in Chinook, you know, if you can write anything resembling a sentence, they usually pat you on the head and send you on your way, But at the university here, they were a little more demanding, you know. And so I started getting an education. Freshman comp was, you know, more of an eye-opener than anything. But I think I struggled through there with a C. But I did better as a sophomore. And then I think, you know, and as a junior, I did, you know, fairly well. And But I hadn't quite caught the writing bug yet, you know.
Did Ed come back into the picture for you after that? Then,
well,
'68, you said.
Yeah. I've been kind of. Oh. flirting with the edges of the radical scene, you know, and because most of my friends were artists and goofballs of one kind or another, you know.
Radicals.
Yeah. You know, so I knew a lot of those people, but I didn't, you know, but at the same time I was still intent on a military career, so I was trying to sort of keep my nose clean, but the Vietnam War was getting me more and more of an ugly mess and harder to support, you know, on any level, and so I started, you know, just taking notice of the people who were protesting the war, and and I knew Barclay Coon. I'd taken classes from him, and he was my advisor. I should have known things weren't going to turn out the way I figured just when Barclay turned out to be my advisor, but anyways, the Arrow Realty demonstration, I was in the thick of that, which was, you know, the spring of 68, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and we had this little meeting, and Frank Sonnenberg was involved, and Bob Howlett, and Danny Bluen was he was there. I don't know if Ed was at that meeting or not, but anyway, the next day, I have trouble with this stuff because I don't talk that much.
Yeah, he's in the drink. Or? Here, let me pause this. Record button, I guess. Okay, you ready? There we go.
Okay. Well, anyway, when King got shot down there in Memphis, you know, it was one of those shots that was heard around the world. I mean, that just kind of, everything was sort of just teetering on the edge, and that just sort of tipped it over, kind of, you know. And we were, you know, the university, you know, went along with having a memorial service there on the Oval, you know, and Ulysses Dawes spoke, and quite a few, you know, Cliver spoke, and Father Ferguson probably spoke, and you know, and probably some black students, and then after the service was over, it was announced that there was an unflattering sign featuring Dr. King in a window of a local realty across the river, and we were going to go down, march across there, and ask them to remove the sign. And we thought, well, there'll be maybe, you know, 10, 15, 20 of us on this, you know. And so we head out, marching across Madison Street Bridge. And at one point, I don't know, I think maybe I was walking with Sonnenberg or somebody, and I turn around, and Jesus Christ, there's like 300 people following me. Holy moly, what's all this, you know? And this is kind of more or less spontaneous. Nobody planned on this, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, by the time we got to the old Arrow Realty there on East Main Street, you know, they'd had enough sense to take the sign down. So the point of our protest had largely been removed. But but anyway, by the time we got there, Wally Clark was there with a squad of cops. And, you know, and then he told us, oh, you guys got to disperse, and Barclay said, well, we just want to talk to this guy for a bit, you know, and Wally says, well, you know, Barclay, I know you're a Quaker, you have to be like this, but the rest of these people don't have any excuse. So I don't know, here we all are, and somebody yells, sit down. So we sit down, and everybody lock, you know, like the old
sit in
tactic goes, you know, and so we sit down and lock arms, and we sit there. I don't know, this goes, things go back and forth between, oh, I don't know, several different people. But finally, they break out the mace and start breaking, you know, pulling people up and hauling people off, you know. And I was just peripherally involved in all this. I just kind of stood there in a daze, more or less, you know.
Yeah.
But Ed got arrested, and then he was later, the charges were dropped against him, but, and then, oh, somebody threw a window, or a rock through his window with a nigger lover note attached to it. I remember that being in the paper or something, too. And, but anyway, see, that's all, like, we just kind of all got thrown together there, you know, and we had it, got up a bunch of money and got everybody bailed out of jail, you know, and then old Bob Campbell came to the fore, and I think Milt Dotsopoulos was involved in the defense of the protesters as well back in those days. Milt was just a young guy starting out too, you know, and Bob Campbell later served on the Constitutional Convention. But all this is, of course, incidental to add, you know. But anyways, I mean, so I got more and more thrown in with the radical element, so to speak, and Paul Warwick and Jenny and Bluen and you know, my friends Mike Hennessy, Bob Gazelle, and you know, John W. Anderson, and over the course of the next year, you know, we got to know each other better. But my first real strong memory I had was in the fall, probably of '68. I'd come back from hanging around in Seattle from my senior year to university, and I was hanging around with Hennessy and Gazelle, and we'd probably eaten a little bit of mescaline or something, you know, kind of got a little bit of a buzz going, and we didn't have much. We just decided we'd go up and see Jenny and hang out with her for a while up on Wiley Street. And
Jenny
Warwick.
Up Warwick's, in Missoula on Wiley Street.
Yeah, up the rattlesnake there, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, we're just sitting around there kind of goofing, and I'm leafing through a book of Andy Wyeth paintings, you know, and just kind of tripping on that, because I knew a guy out in Seattle who had a talent similar to Wyeth's and could paint with that kind of realism, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I hear this voice in the kitchen, this booming voice, you know, and I reading it, I said, that's why, I know that it's poetry, but I don't really know any more than that. And there's this big old guy out in the kitchen, you know, and it turns out to be Leahy, and he's reading from Rethke's The Lost Son. And that's the first exposure, a direct exposure I ever had to Ed, you know. And I was just kind of, you know, but again, you know, I was sort of like on the periphery of the radical movement around here, you know, and I ended up dropping out of ROTC to protest the war, and also, you know, I realized that I didn't really have any, that being an Army officer wasn't really what I wanted to do, but.
Were you writing at that time? Did you start writing poetry yet? No.
I kind of started writing a little bit, I guess, that summer in Seattle, but Well, you know, I've got all this written down in a fair amount of detail in this memoir I've been writing, but.
So after then, you were a friend of Ed's, but not yet at that juncture, is what you're saying. You were much younger, I guess.
Yeah, I was a lot younger than he was, you know, and you know, our paths had crossed. We knew a lot of the same people, you know, and we were involved in some of the same demonstrations, And, you know, I eventually graduated and went down to San Francisco and spent nearly a year down there before I came back up here. And then I had to deal with the draft and eventually became a conscientious objector. And, things just kind of moved along. You know, I mean, the Warwicks left town and went over to England for a while, and they moved around quite a bit too, you know, and it just sort of, things kind of, you know, just dispersed. People were kind of, you know, the war kind of started fading away into oblivion, you know, it took a long time for it to fade away for a lot, most of us. But
what year did the Warwicks leave?
Well, they
early 70s.
Yeah, I think the last year that Paul taught here was 70. I think 70 was the last year that he taught here. Ian Bluen left, I think, at the same time, and then Ed was around, you know, and he was still married then, I think, and Dexter was around, you know, and Barkley had left a year before because his contract was up and he hadn't been able to finish his dissertation, so they didn't renew his contract, and he went to Minnesota, I didn't probably really get to know Ed really well until later on, you know. Mm-hmm. I first knew of him in those days, and then, I bounced around, worked on the railroad, and traveled to Mexico, and did all this stuff, you know. But I probably didn't really even.
Do you remember the? Do you remember? Were you around or with the publication of the first book, his first book, the first Blind Horses publication?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was, 79 something, I think?
Oh, 79 or 80, probably, 79. That sounds about right, yeah. he'd do readings and stuff every once in a while.
Prior to that?
Yeah. I remember there used to be this little bookstore over there on East Broadway, in that building where Bell Pipe Shop is, and
oh, yeah.
I think it's in that space. It was in that space where that computer outfit is, or maybe Bell was in that space and she was in the. Anyway, this gallery had this bookstore over there, which is kind of a, you know, like along the lines of Fact and Fiction or the Shakespeare downstairs, but she'd hold readings in there, you know. And I remember Ed giving a reading in there one time. He had his, you know, leather jacket on, and he was all slicked up, you know, and he told us this hilarious story about getting in trouble flying this airplane, you know, and how he just, you know, I think he's probably told this story quite a few times, but it was just funnier than hell the way he told. I can't even begin to approach it. I can just barely remember that he told it at all, you know.
Right.
But he was always an impressive reader, you know, and a performer. And when he gave a reading, you got your money's worth out of the deal, you know.
Yeah.
And we knew about each other, and I just, you know. Koch was doing the Montana Gothic, and I was involved in that. And
that was what year?
Oh, we started that in 74, and the last issue came out in 77. And then Peter moved down to San Francisco, and I went down there for... And I got put out my little book, Fossil Fuel, came out the spring of 77, and then Peter moved down to San Francisco in the fall. And I went down there with him, kind of. I'm a couple weeks behind him, but I mean, I spent the winter down there goofing around and decided to come back up here and Ed was moved over to Butte, you know, and he was living over in Butte, and so I don't think I really got to know Ed until he, you know, survived Warm Springs and came over here, moved over here, and then we kind of got to be hanging out together some, you know, and
roughly what, mid-80s, or what time frame do you say, would you say, when he moved?
Oh,
back?
I would say probably late 80s, early 90s, probably. Yeah. And, you know, and he was living over there in the old warden house there upstairs there for a while, and holed up there and writing, and we'd show each other stuff, and I'd get letters from him with poems in them and stuff like that, you know, so I was always a trip, you know, to have that kind of communication going on, you know.
Right.
And so we were, you know, we'd been through a lot of, we'd each been in our own way through a lot of stuff, you know, by that time, you know. So he'd probably been through a lot more intense stuff than me, but, you know, nonetheless, we traveled around some and done some writing, and
you had this, once you became better friends in the early 90s whenever he moved back here, then you had this shared past or people that,
yeah,
like the Warwicks.
Yeah, so, you know, so we had a you know, a prior history, you know, that we could relate to each other through, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and he'd become more of a presence, though, in my life in those days, you know, and he was an encouraging presence, you know, in terms of, you know, he'd more so than other people might have were,
yeah,
at the time, you know.
He respected your poetry.
Yeah, and whatever I tried to do, you know, he always gave me an encouraging a nod, you know, and that helps, you know. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and then Roger, of course, I've always been in contact with Roger and
Roger
Dunsmore, you know, so, you know, and so between, you know, Roger and Ed, and, you know, we just all knew each other through the, well, you know, it was Roger really who opened my eyes to the possibilities of writing more than anybody, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he got me to start keeping a journal, you know, in a kind of sort of a semi-conscientious way during the seminars that I took from him when I was a senior at the university, and so I kind of, it's where I kind of established my writing practice there, you know, but he, you know, he and Ed were always pretty close, you know, and so, you know, we just kind of always sort of been hanging around with each other, you know. It's just,
right.
You know, and it's, you know.
So, I know that, do you have any stories or recollections, or how did the whole Garden City reading series, Ed was involved in that, right?
Well, that was primarily John and Judy Holbrook and me and Pat Todd. And who else? God, I forget who all else was.
Roger
was involved in that too, yeah. And then that Helen, she was involved for a while. She was a pain in the ass. But well, she was, Jesus. You know,
and I mean, not to pour salt on the wounds, but clarify that name again.
Well, she went. Oh, I don't think that, you know. she was around, but her presence wasn't what she thought it was, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
No, the Garden City Reading Series there was, that was primarily Holbrook, John and Judy Holbrook and Roger, and I helped a little bit, Ed read, I think several times, come over from Butte and read, and then when he came back here, we kept that going for 3 or 4 years, I think, but...
Mainly as a guest.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I don't think he was really involved in a day-to-day organization of it, which finally just pretty much became me and Holbrook head toward the end, yeah. But that's how those things go, They're interesting for a while, and everybody gets a shot at it, and then suddenly, after a couple of years, people say, I think I'll go fishing, or whatever else comes to mind as being more interesting to do.
Yeah. Well, you talked about Ed and politics and war, and you mentioned his time in Warm Springs. Any other things connected with any of those activities that come to mind that you or bear worth mentioning from your point of view? Or
well, I didn't know Ed on a real intimate day-to-day basis, and I start. Paths would cross every once in a while, and then when he moved here, we got to know each other. We saw each other with more frequency, and he'd come into Charlie's was going full bore by then, and so he'd come into Charlie's every once in a while, and sometimes he'd come in with Roger, and we'd sit around and bullshit some, and then they'd move on, and. Like I say, every once in a while I go over to see him when he was living over there in the old Warden House there on East Pine Street, and he was, working on probably early versions of the Fresh Air Gang, and I know he was working on that story of Queen Wilhelmina's Mine, so he read me a version of that, which I thought was hilarious, I thought he should publish that right away, but it didn't get published until you guys put it in Sedalia there. So
yeah, and I saw several different kinds of variations and versions of that thing. I mean, he worked that thing for a long time. In part, I've seen versions where part was just the dream, the mule, the talking mule. And then later on, that how he opens that thing with the psychiatrist and that whole discussion with the psychiatrist, that's a masterful scene. That's a study in mental health right there.
Yeah,
the patient and the doctor, Well, I know that when we're done here, I'm going to ask you to read a couple of things, just because I know you have a couple of things where Ed shows up in poems that you've written. But do you have any sort of memorable or comic? Or not necessarily. I mean, any story with Ed that sticks in mind that maybe people haven't possibly heard or anything that discussion or anything. I mean, one of the things that I know you said in a quote on Ed's book, the one that the university did, was that Ed Leahy is the chief of us old Montana poets.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of. By that time, we'd kind of been doing a few readings together, and But you know, he was kind of, you know, and you know, I mean, he always liked to buff up your buddies, you know, and but you know, he was the old chief, you know, kind of, and he'd written some really strong stuff, you know, and I just, you know, I was always tried to, whenever we read together, always wanted to go first, if possible.
Yeah, he was a strong reading voice. But he also had that strong presence.
Yeah.
I mean, even when he wasn't reading poetry, just...
Oh, yeah, he always knew he was around. That, you know... I finally got Buck's Last Wreck together, and it was about to come out, you know, but hadn't come out yet. He came up here and knocked on the door, and he says, "Well, where's my copy of Buck's Last Wreck?" And I said, "Well, man, we haven't got them from the printer yet." He says, "Well, be sure to bring me one." And I said, "Oh, all right." You know, so I made sure he got one, you know. He was involved. He always, he wrote that little thing, you know, that's in the back of Hellgate Wind, you know, and that's just kind of, you know, to have a guy like Ed take notice of your work and giving an appreciative comment, you know, that always makes you feel good, you know. And
yeah, that's pretty important.
Yeah, you know, it makes you feel like you're not completely wasting your time anyway, you know.
Yeah, because I mean, you, as I've heard it almost from everybody who's had, you know, any kind of encounters with Ed over the years, you know, other than some kind of crazier encounters, and maybe, you know, alcohol over the edge kind of things. But I mean, just the impressive nature of the intensity and the generosity too, to all those people who were in the same, you know, boat kind of, or
yeah,
trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, well, we'd all been kind of cast aside by the university at one point or another. Of course, I never was involved there anyway, but you know, I mean, yeah, Ed would have been happy to teach a couple of seconds comp at a certain point, just because just for the income, if nothing else, you know.
Exactly.
But you know, by then, of course, they had other people. You know, that's just how that goes.
Yeah. Son of a bitch. Okay. All right. It must be back on. Yes, it is. So, just in conclusion, anything you want to say about? Anything you want to say about Ed's place in literature, or as a human being, or in conclusion, or anything?
Well, I don't have, you know, any idea what any, you know, where any of us will end up in terms of literary history in the United States or Montana. But I would suspect that Ed would loom fairly large, at least in the literary history of Montana, you know. And he's written poems there that I don't think anybody will ever equal, you know. You know, for he had a unique voice, and he had some deep history behind that voice, you know. And so, you know, it was an honor just to hang out with him, you know, and to learn a few licks from him, and just, you know, I'm just glad to have been his friend.
Yep.
You know, finally, you know.
Right. That good?
I think so.
Thanks.
Yeah.